Hello, this is Larry Poza. I'm the pastor of Shade Tree Community Church. Violence at political rallies, terrorism, and horrifying public shootings often bewilder us. From everyday road rage to domestic violence to hatred and racism, what are the root causes of our violent nature? This is our fall Bible study topic. We meet each Thursday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at the First Christian Church in downtown Willoughby. We meet down in the social hall for a time of learning and fellowship and dialogue. Join us anytime that you can at 4249 River Street in downtown Willoughby. If you can't join us, thank you for dialing into this podcast, and we hope that you now enjoy the Bible study. God bless you. So tonight we're going to transition from the first root cause that I'm sharing with you of violence in the world to the second one. And what we've been talking about over the last few weeks is this connection between how mankind imagines God. And since we are made in the image of God, sometimes we project onto God some of the things that is more in tune with our nature than God's nature. So I want to start off with a quote. This goes all the way back to a guy by Xenophanes, lived between 570 and 478 BC. He said, "If oxen and horses and lions had hands and were able to draw with their hands and do the same things as men, horses would draw the shapes of gods to look like horses and oxen to look like oxen, and each would have made the gods' bodies to have the same shapes as they themselves had." That's an interesting observation, because when you look into the ancient world, when we were talking a little bit about the different alternative creation stories, such as the Babylonian creation story, you have the Egyptian creation story, things like that, God is often projected as a dominant alpha type being that is reflecting his rage and his anger toward the sub-gods that are created. So what we've been talking a little bit about out of Genesis is the difference between the word Elohim and Yahweh. That in Genesis chapter 1, the word Elohim, a plural name, is found, but in Genesis chapter 2, the name Yahweh is found. And the key question is, why is there a change of names between the chapters? Two accounts of creation, two different names for God. And we said that maybe this word Elohim reflects the cultural perspective of the day. Because in some of the Psalms that we looked at, we saw that God is kind of the chairman of the divine council. You remember a few of the Psalms that he is above the gods, plural. Now, we don't believe there's plurality of gods, but they did in the ancient world. And so that then kind of becomes the first root cause that many times what happens is while we are made in the image of God, mankind has the tendency to return the favor and make the gods in their image. Okay? So having said that, if you take the concept of a dominant alpha male, and that's often how God is portrayed in the scriptures, Old Testament especially, that God is the dominant alpha male, then is God also the dominant ape? In other words, if there is such a thing as evolution and the evolution of ideas, could it be that the majority of the world's plural believers in all kinds of religions around the world often worship a God that is fearsome and male? So there are female gods, but they're often the sub-gods, not the dominant or the head god. So I put a couple of sub-points here. Extremists drunk on this vision rains fury upon enemies and slaughters the unfaithful. We see some of that in the Old Testament, don't we? They start inquisitions and witch hunts, sometimes religious wars and crusades, which is a part of the Christian heritage as well. They also seek to enforce a prohibition against questioning God, and you're not allowed to ask questions about some of the inhumanities. That's just the way it is. So, in other words, on Mount Sinai, when God gives the law and 3,000 people are slaughtered, if you're faithful, you're not allowed to question, was that right? Was that right? Because you got to be true to this dominant being. And could it be that that is more of our projection than it is God's nature? So is this the ultimate survival of the fittest template? That there in the ancient world is a belief in a variety and multitude of gods, but there's one God that is the dominant one, and he is the survival of the fittest. And then this is the God that creates this man and woman in Genesis chapter 1. And then, if that's our perception of God, that he is a dominant male, that he is fearsome, that he's often angry, and he often slaughters men, women, children, and cattle, i.e. the Canaanites, then maybe one of the first root causes of our tendency to violence is we're just following the example of the God we claim to follow. That's my premise. Because then when you have this type of God, the way to appease that God is to be a faithful believer. And let's take Islam, for example. A very male-dominant image of God, Allah, that's then reflected in the culture, so much so that women have to cover themselves. They're not allowed to be seen in public without head coverings or sometimes veils. And what is the ultimate expression of fidelity toward this God, Allah? It's jihad. It's jihad. Killing the infidels, killing the unbelievers. Well, that goes right back to the image of God that they have. That's not the God that's portrayed in the person of Christ. So, in many world religions, mankind is often as bad as the image they have of God. Does that make sense? You have questions or comments on that? Just something to think about, okay? So, which then causes us to often reflect, too, about our own heritage. And that is, could in the Old Testament, many of the portraits that you have of God have been colored and shaped by the culture and the common belief about the gods? Yeah. And that's one of the things I think Jesus then had to come and over and change, okay? So here's what I would like for us to do, and I'm going to finish then this root cause number one, and then we're going to go into a different cause, okay? If God is one of violence and retribution, then we who are made in his image will naturally have some of the same DNA. What if mankind from the start has misunderstood the nature of God? How would a better understanding of God change that orientation? So it seems as though that's one of the things Jesus had to root out of his own disciples. So let's go over to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. And I use this as part of my sermon, but I want to re-examine it here tonight for a few moments. So if you look at verse 46 in Luke 9, you have the ultimate male argument, and that is there is an argument about who is the greatest. Look at verse 46. An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Women can be competitive, but I don't think they carry nearly the intensity that men have in competition and the desire. And that's what sports thrive on, okay? The desire to be the greatest and the best and that type of thing. Again, women have this drive as well, but it seems as though this becomes a part of the male nature. It's not just in sports, it's in business. So you can't just be a good businessman or a successful businessman. You have to be the best businessman. You have to be on top. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay. That's in the disciples here. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. And then he said to them, "Whoever welcomes this child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For he who is least among you all, he's the greatest." So he's flipped the script upside down. No, it's not who's the greatest, it's who's the humblest. Okay? "Master," said John, "we saw a man driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not," what? "One of us." What's the implication? We're better than they are. Okay? Jesus said, "Do not stop him, for whoever is not against you is for you." That's backwards to the way we think. Okay? Whoever's not for you is against you. He says, whoever's not against you is for you. It's complete opposite. Then he says here, at the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And as he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him, but the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. So anyone that's heading for Jerusalem is individuals that are dedicated to Judaism. The Samaritans are half Jews and half Gentiles. Now notice verse 54. This is critically important. When the disciples, James and John, saw this, they asked, "Lord, do you want us to call fire down from heaven to destroy them?" Now, doesn't that seem to be a bit extreme? Okay, why wouldn't they just move on? No, do you want us to destroy these people? And Jesus turned and rebuked them. So all of a sudden he's saying, this isn't the way it works. This is not the way followers of my kingdom are going to act. And then if you have time, you could read 2 Kings chapter 1. That's where this idea comes from. So James and John are just following the idea of Elijah. And Elijah calls down fire three times in 2 Kings chapter 1. And they think they are being faithful to Jesus by wanting to do the same thing.
They're just doing what one of the greatest did.
That's right. So. That's right. So, but Jesus is saying, are you nuts? Are you crazy? So, okay, so we've laid that down. Now, turn over to John chapter 14. John 14. Now, many times when we read John chapter 14, we all think that this passage primarily is about how you get into heaven. When you think about verses 1 through 6, that culminates with verse 6, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." So, you know, I read this all the time in different funerals that I do. "Do not let your hearts be troubled. You trust in God, trust in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I'm going. But here's the question. Thomas said, Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way? Jesus answered, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, most of the time we think you can't get into heaven without going through Christ. I don't think that's the point of this passage, okay? The point of the passage is in the verse 7. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and you have seen him. The essence of this passage is, what is God really like? If you have seen me, you have seen God. So Philip raises his hand and says, Lord, verse 8, show us the Father, and that will be enough for me. Jesus answered, don't you know me, Philip? Even after I have been with you such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? I've been showing you the Father all along. If you want to know what God's like, look at me.
Right, but that doesn't deny that Jesus is...
No. But I don't think that's the central idea.
Right.
It's an application.
Right.
But the core of it is, okay, you're going away. What are we going to do? And then... what you have here is Jesus turning. Here's what I want you to do. You've seen my life. You've watched it. Now do the same thing. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And that you might go, no one comes to know the Father except through me. That can be a personal relationship, or it can be a conceptual thing too. And that is, how do we know what God is really like? We know what God is like because we look at Jesus. And then he says here, down to verse 10, don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? In other words, I am the embodiment of what God is like. Okay? If you look at me, you see God. It is the Father that is living in me who is doing his work. So whatever I'm doing, that is what God is like. I'm telling you, this is a powerful, powerful paragraph, because what it does is it sheds light on the question I think all mankind struggles with. What is God really like? What is God really like? And the answer Jesus gives is, look at me and you see God. Comments, questions, concerns?
And that's what got him killed.
Yeah.
He was heretic.
That's right. That's exactly right.
From the point of view of the scribes and the Sanhedrin.
Yeah, that's exactly right. These type of teachings would lend them to say he's a blasphemer.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So my point in all this is, now you can understand Luke chapter 9. When James and John say, should we call down fire from heaven to consume people who don't agree with us, Jesus is saying, you're missing the whole point of what my life is all about. I am showing you what God is really like. And that's the point of this paragraph. One more, Hebrews chapter 1. So go to the right in your Bible and almost all the way to the end of the New Testament. And we're given a pinpoint of the ultimate revelation of God in this paragraph. So it says in verse 1, in the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. So he goes back and he's saying, God has revealed himself in a variety of ways through a variety of different people. However, in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the universe. In other words, in case you don't know, he is the Almighty God. He created the universe. And then it says in verse 3, this God, this ultimate God, is revealed in Christ. The Son, Jesus, is the radiance of God's glories, and this is the most important phrase in the verse, the exact representation of his being. The exact representation of his being. So, if you want to know what God's like, you look at Jesus because he's the exact representation of what God is like. Does that make sense? Then in the next verse it says, after he provided purification from sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. Just in case you don't know, God put his stamp of approval on Jesus. He was raised from the dead, he was ascended, and he was exalted at the right hand of God. So he became as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is superior to theirs. So here's my point as we wrap this up. I think a tendency that mankind has is to struggle with the question, who is God and what is he like? And since we are made in God's image, one of the things that we will often do is figure that if I can come to a conclusion of what God is like, then I am like that too. That's a part of who I am. So if you have an evil, ugly, pagan, capricious, unpredictable God, then the tendency is those who are his worshipers will carry some of those characteristics as well. Because it's, you are just part of the lineage of the God that made you. Rather than we taking responsibility that we've rejected the true God and we've created this God in our own image. And that is the ultimate thing that we call what? Idolatry. Idolatry is creating God in our image, not God creating us in his. Comments or questions there? Okay, so we've taken 3 weeks to kind of lay all the groundwork for that. That kind of sums it up. So we want to go to a different root cause. This cause is called mimetic desire. Mimetic desire. And it's a phrase that comes from a French scholar named René Girard. And the idea behind it is at the root of violence is desire. Okay? Desire can be the most life-giving force. Everybody desires something in life. It inspires us sometimes to do wonderful things. The desire to help, the desire to serve, the desire to love. But it can be a destructive force as well that causes harm to other people and sometimes to ourselves as well. So, mimesis is a Greek word from mimethai, meaning to imitate. Now, here's the theory of René Girard. He was studying the chronic problem of violence in the world. And he said that many times we think that mankind is violent because of our differences. We see things differently, and we fight because we see things differently. We have different values, that type of thing. His proposal is that, and I put it here, while we might assume that violence stems from having different points of view, Girard's central insight is that violence actually grows from similarity. And that is, we all want the same thing. Next, his explanation in a word is imitation. Out of this insight, Girard spun a theory comprehending literature, religion, anthropology, and international relationships. And that is, we mimic each other, and when we see something that someone else has, we desire the same thing. Okay, so here's René Girard. He lived from 1923 to 2015. He said, the human genius is our knack for copying one another. That's how infants learn vocabulary and the basic grammar of their native language in an astonishingly short amount of time. And that's how we learn everything in our vast cultural repertoire. So you have a granddaughter, a grandson, or your son or your daughter. And all along, you begin talking to them. And one of the things that parents and grandparents do with kids is say blue, say red, say whatever. And they begin to pick up vocabulary by you saying it over and over and over again, and they begin to mimic you, okay? So say mama. That's one of the first ones. Say dada. And the idea is you keep reinforcing it long enough, eventually it comes out. Now, on other vocabulary, they'll mess it up. And it's quite humorous at times, but you will correct them. So I remember Kevin, he loved gumball machines, but he couldn't talk, he couldn't say the word gumball machine. And we'd say, oh, that's a gumball machine. Here's a quarter to put in it to get a gumball. And he used to call it a gumballution. A gumballution. No, it's not a gumballution. It's a gumball machine. Well, eventually he learned that, and he began to say it right, okay? So here's the idea. Next point. Some of our models are near at hand, our friends and family. Others may be distant idols, such as actors, whose gestures we adopt, athletes whose moves we practice. Okay, every kid tries to imitate LeBron, how he dunks the ball. Okay, musicians whose ways of playing we emulate as well. So in other words, part of the human spirit is we imitate. And we look at someone that we respect and we say, I want to be like that individual. But imitation can also cast a shadow. According to Girard, creating effects which we often don't notice or don't recognize as forms of imitation. So a son or daughter grows up in an abusive home, and they subconsciously begin to absorb some of the same mannerisms and attitudes as their parents, and all of a sudden they get married and they begin to treat their spouse exactly as it was modeled for them over the course of their childhood. Okay? The truth Girard discovered is that all of us desire not only what material items and personal qualities each other possess, but we also desire the very desires of the other. So that's a deep thought. So I found a video that I think will help for you to understand it. Watch.
Everyone knows that living life means making choices. But how do we make choices? Why do we pick one thing instead of another? René Girard gave a simple answer. It's called mimetic desire. We usually explain why we want something in one of two ways. We say we want it because it suits our unique preferences, or we highlight the objective good qualities something has. Either way, we claim to choose autonomously, in isolation from others. While he was reading and teaching classic literature, Girard realized that the great writers reveal a deeper layer of our psychology. Girard saw that in the classic works, there is always a model, someone the protagonist admires and wants to be like. Just as the protagonist in a novel imitates an appealing model, we all pattern our choices on somebody else's example. It might be a celebrity we've never met, or it could be our best friend we've known all our lives. Man is the creature who does not know what to desire, said Girard. He turns to others in order to make up his mind. We desire what others desire because we imitate their desires. Instead of being direct and autonomous, I want that. Our desires are derivative and triangular. I want that just because someone else wants it. Gerard's insight sheds light on financial bubbles, fashion, social media, and every human interaction. It explains why people fight even when there's plenty to go around, and why conflicts are often worst when the stakes are smallest. When we model our desires on those of others, we end up competing for the same jobs, the same mates, the same real estate, and the same social status as everyone else. What's the solution? Gerard said, imitation is inevitable, so we can't just stop imitating. The most important choice in each of our lives may not be where to go to school, what career to pursue, or even who to marry. It may be who to imitate.
Let's stop there for a second. So if that is true, and I think it is. So I remember when I was a kid, I was a paper boy, and I had my buddy who was, he helped me with the paper route. And, you know, I'd give him a certain amount of money for helping me on Wednesday and Thursday, which were the big advertisement days of the Akron Beacon Journal. And so he was getting some money, I was getting some money. But I remember when we both had, do you remember banana seat bicycles with the high handlebars? We both had that. But one day, he came pulling up with a 10-speed bicycle. So he had saved up the money from us working together. And I remember distinctly that I no longer felt that the banana seat bicycle was cool. And the reason was because he had a 10-speed bike. And it arose the desire within me to get one too. So I did. And I think that's an illustration of what René Girard is trying to say, is that when we all desire things, but then there's a certain power structure of people that we really look up to that we desire what they already have. Let's go back to the Garden of Eden. In Genesis chapter 3, the downfall of Adam and Eve was what? Desire. So God says, you can eat from any tree in the garden except from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And instead of her wanting to be satisfied and knowing her limitations, she desired the tree that was prohibited. So even at the very root of our humanity is seeing this desire that we tend to use and misuse for various things. So if that is true, that we learn through imitation, and that the only way we can resolve certain things that we want is by using force, then violence is not far behind. So that's at the root of a lot of different things, but let's take the most obvious, oil. All nations want oil. Certain nations have oil reserves. We want it. How do we get it? Instead of coming up with alternative ways of running our cars, which there are those out there, whether it's natural gas or the biggest one is corn, that could be, I mean, have you looked at the midsection of our country? We could grow enough corn to run every automobile in the world, if you know. But we want oil. And so we position all of our politics, we position everything in, and here's what we say. It's in our national what? Interest. It's in our national interest. Now, if something gets in the way of that desire, we have to get rid of it. Or at least we have to control it. Otherwise, we won't get what we want. So this goes all the way back to the garden. That's what I want. And then we hear the serpent that says, you know that God? That God is so bad and mean. He's withholding from you good things. And then that becomes the justification for her to make the decision. And then Adam follows right behind. It's not her. It's both of them. Okay? So here's what Rene Girard says. We are interdividual. I can't say things tonight. Interdividual. As adults, even as autonomous as we are as Americans, we learn and desire by imitation. We never stop learning nor desiring through the process of imitation. And our desires are borrowed from one another. I will desire what my models desire. So whoever becomes most important in our mind, what they want is what we will want to imitate. Take overly priced basketball shoes. Michael Jordan, LeBron James. Now, why are those double the cost than other basketball shoes made by Nike? Because it has the name Jordan or the name LeBron on it. No other reason than that. So they're our hero. We want to imitate. And, you know, so what is some of the most stolen items at school? Expensive Jordan shoes or LeBron shoes. So if you leave that in your locker and you don't leave your locker locked, those things are going to be gone.
They walk away.
Because of this desire. Okay? So, I'm going to show you another video before we're done tonight. Maybe this is where violence is born. Imitation may then become negative as rivals try to distinguish themselves from one another. I will imitate by doing the opposite of what my rival does at times. And so there's a violent reciprocity which reaches ultimate expression in war. We fight because we are the same, not because we are different. When your desires get in the way of my desires, then you must be eliminated. You got to get out of the way. If this dynamic remains on a singular level, when violence of all against one, the threat of collapse occurs. So in other words, now you got to follow with me here for a moment. If everybody is eliminating everybody else because we all want the same things, civilization will collapse. It will no longer exist. So what happens, and this is an extension of this theory, if this dynamic remains singular, I get into a fist fight with you, you get into a fist fight with me. But if it becomes international, and you put nuclear weapons into the mix, all of mankind is threatened. So there's a second thing that kicks in. The scapegoat mechanism kicks in so that the whole can survive. A scapegoat must be found that unites the community by expressing the anger felt by blocked desires. So this is where racism comes in. One group of people thinks then that the other group of people is the cause of all the problems in the world. It's those, fill in the blank. So there's a projection, unfortunately, upon the gay community too. They're the problems of everything in the country. It's the scapegoat mechanism. So I found another video that will, I think, help you to see that. Okay, let's watch.
There's a thinker, René Girard, who's very brilliant. He was an anthropologist and he was a literary theorist and a philosopher of sorts.
And he came up with this very sophisticated argument for why violence and resentment exists the way it does in human communities. And so the theory starts with this idea that human beings mimic each other. We learn through mimicry. We have mirror neurons in our brains, but basically when you smile at a child, the child smiles. If you cry, it might provoke someone else to cry. And this is incredibly important for the development of the human species and community, that we can influence each other, that we share our desires, etc., etc. But one of the issues with mimetic desire is I don't just mimic you know, what you do. I don't just learn from you. I also learn about what you desire. And I mimic your desire. So what happens is I start to desire what the people around me desire. So I learn what's desirable, not directly through just liking chess or liking TV or whatever. I learn what's desirable by copying the desire of other people. But this causes a problem. So mimetic desire is the whole foundation of society. It's the foundation of how we can create civilization. But hard baked into it is this idea that we start to all desire similar things. And this causes violence. Because as soon as we start fighting over a partner or money or something, then the only way to resolve it is through, you know, we get into a fight and then maybe eventually one of us dies. So hard baked into civilization is this violence that erupts because we all start desiring similar things. You see it every, you know, somebody goes to a restaurant, one person buys a meal, and so the other person, suddenly, you know, they want to order the same thing. Or someone starts to find a person attractive because somebody else does. Or in relationships, you know, you start to desire what the other person desires. They're into French film or something, so you take an interest. And then weirdly, you think it's your desire, but it was actually given to you by the other person. So whenever two people split up, they start to fight over things like, you know, these albums are my albums. You go like, you know, but no, that's the band that I love. And you go like, no, I introduced you to that band. So weirdly, you know, all of our desires are intermingled. So for Girard, the idea is, well, how does society prevent all-out war? How do you manage violence? And he says that basically what happened is originally communities would get together, the violence and the resentment would get bigger and bigger until someone died, someone was killed. And then that would chill everybody out for a while. And I would kill you, and then I would, you know, take your stuff, and I would be happy. And What's that?
Mean,
yes, but fair.
Also, what are you going to take?
Yeah. There's not much to the enviable in your thing. Yeah, that duvet cover's nice. You've got in the bed.
Yeah, thank you. Amazon.
Yeah. So we kind of like, there's a violence erupts, somebody's killed, that chills everybody out for a bit. So what happens then is religion comes in, and one of religion's founding rules is to manage this violence, to make sure it doesn't destroy everybody. So then religion starts to create structures for this violence to happen. It starts off with human sacrifices, then animal sacrifices. It basically creates a scapegoat. So whenever the violence and the aggression in the community is very big, you kill something, it chills everybody out. Everybody kind of mutually dislikes the scapegoat. You kill the scapegoat and everyone feels a bit better. And so René Girard is saying that's how early societies manage this violence. And then he's got an interesting reading of Christianity. He says that Christianity is the revelation of the scapegoating mechanism, because the idea in mythology is the scapegoat deserves it. The scapegoat, it's ordained by God or the universe or the gods. They, you know, to kill someone is fine, or to kill the animal. But
like in sacrifice?
In sacrifice. So it's all the sacrificial system. But for René Girard, who's not a theologian or anything, but he took an interest in Christianity because he said the whole point of the crucifixion is it's a scapegoating mechanism, but the scapegoat's innocent. So the idea is that the Christian experience is the one where you realize that the scapegoat is not the problem, that the violence is yours. So the idea is that society has to, we have to realize that the violence that we put out onto other people is internal to ourselves. And then when, for Girard, this is where I'm a little bit different from him, but what Girard says is whenever we acknowledge that we have all of this founding violence within us and it's exposed, that can help us relieve it in more productive ways.
Damn, we do a good podcast. That's some good stuff right
yeah.
there. That
yeah.
was good.
In
my mind, I'm thinking about the entire society that we currently live in that is in an insane state right now, or at least it seems to be, and it's very interesting to hear that interpretation or that thing, or like interpret society where we're at through that, what you just said.
Yeah, because in contemporary society, a scapegoat is an enemy. You know, if you've got a society that's falling apart, it's great to blame some individual or some community.
Yeah.
And that gets everybody unified. So the violence of the community is kind of like manageable. And then if you kill the enemy, then there's a moment of cathartic release. But for Girard, it never lasts. That's the problem, because of mimetic desire, then violence will always come back.
Yeah.
So the trick is, how do we actually overcome the violence? That's what I hope we get to at some point in the podcast.
Okay,
but
cool.
This initial bit is just going, oh yeah, like all of us, you know, we desire what the people around us desire. That puts us into conflict with them if there's a limited number of resources. And so we have to find ways to get rid of that resentment and that anger.
Now, the individual that was speaking there, that's Peter Rollins. He is a Christian philosopher. If you want to do a deep read into subjects, you pick up a book of Peter Rollins and you will read and you will reread the same page two or three times. He's very deep, but very insightful. One of the things that we see happening every election cycle, both sides, it's all the Democrats' fault. It's all the Republicans' fault. That's just scapegoat mechanism at its highest level. What does it do? It rallies the troops not to think. We just accept. And we believe every wind of everything that comes along, instead of thinking, well, politicians have this scapegoat mechanism down. They've perfected it. Okay, so I'm just giving you a forewarning. That's what 2020 is going to look like. You're going to see all kinds of scapegoating, and you know it's going to be on both sides, and it will behoove you to take what you've learned tonight to understand that the politician is simply voicing the internal anger and violence that's already in your heart. And then that'll eventually win out because somebody will rally one group of people up enough to get enough votes to become the next president. Kind of scary, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at this, what happens is this is not something that is a contemporary problem. This is a problem that goes all the way back to the beginning of humanity. So when violence is transferred from all against all to all against one, a peace does happen. But as Peter Rollins said, it just happens for a while. It's temporary. And the process inevitably repeats itself. And the key question then becomes, who plays the role of the scapegoat? So if it's a person that stands out from the rest of the group, they become an easy target. So it might be people with deformities, it might be minorities, cultural or racial groups, those who have alternative sexual dispositions, those with different political views, and if the conflict over a desired object becomes too intense, the community subconsciously chooses a scapegoat, which is sacrificed, either literally or metaphorically. So why in ancient religion did it start off with the sacrifice of children and humans before it became animals? because that was what was felt the gods wanted. So everything is projected onto that child or onto that human, and they are sacrificed, and now we are relieved because the gods are now happy with us. What Judaism did in the Old Testament is they transferred this idea from sacrificing a human to an animal. So what is the book of Leviticus all about? Animal sacrifices, okay? And what is the Day of Atonement? It is putting everything onto that animal, and then it is sacrificed, and we are good for another year. It's called Yom Kippur, okay? There's even a scapegoat in the Old Testament. Did you know that? Let's go over to the book of Leviticus, and that's where we'll stop tonight. I'll come back to this. Remember, next week we have a guest speaker, okay? So we won't be in this topic next week. We'll come back to this 2 weeks from tonight. But I do want to show you this. Go to Leviticus chapter 16, and we won't read this whole chapter. I do want you to remain my friend, okay? Leviticus chapter 16. So this is all of the rituals that are prescribed for the Day of Atonement, or as our Jewish friends call it, Yom Kippur, okay? So the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron. We didn't get into that, but they didn't meet the criteria to be priests, so God eliminated them. The Lord told, said to Moses, verse 2, tell your brother Aaron not to come whenever he chooses into the most holy place behind the curtain in front of the atonement cover on the ark, or else he will die because I appear in the cloud over the atonement cover. Okay, so there's all these different things about what they are to do. Jump down to verse 6. Aaron is to offer the bull for his own sin offering to make atonement for himself and his household. Then he is to take two goats and present them before the Lord at the entrance to the tent of meeting. He's to cast lots for the two goats, and one lot is for the Lord and the other for the scapegoat. There it is, right there. Okay, so one of these goats are going to be a scapegoat. Aaron shall bring the goat whose lot falls to the Lord and sacrifice it as a sin offering. But the goat chosen by lot as the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to be used for making atonement by sending it into the desert as a scapegoat. So two goats on the Day of Atonement. One sacrifice to appease God, and the other is all the sins, all the violence, all the dysfunction of civilization is placed upon this other goat, and it is driven out into the desert, and it better not come back. It's supposed to die out in the desert, okay? So what this entails, and the word for scapegoat here is the word Azazel, and it is the idea that, okay, somebody's got to take the blame. But instead of making a person take the blame, we will use animals to take the blame. We'll sacrifice one, we'll kill it. The other will drive out, symbolically saying, at least for another year, we can appease this God by taking this goat and driving it out into the wilderness. Okay? So the idea of a scapegoat is rooted deep into the religious tradition of the Old Testament. When Jesus comes along, he says he's come to fulfill the law and the prophets. He wants to put an end to it. Enough of the killing already. And one of the things that he does is he takes the sins of the world upon himself, and he allows himself to be the scapegoat, to be sacrificed once and for all so that sin is no longer a problem. That's the book of Hebrews in great detail. That's what the book of Hebrews is about.
Right, but then he becomes the two goats, the sacrificial and the scapegoat.
Right. And the great picture of the cross is not just one theory of the atonement, but probably several. And that is, he dies so that he might kill sin, okay? The other is he takes upon himself the sins of the world. And then he says from the cross, as he is hung there as a scapegoat, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. So he says basically that this very motivation of humanity, because what is it that that they do to Jesus? In Mark chapter 15, verse 3, the chief priests accused him of many crimes. He's the scapegoat. He's the problem. He's leading people astray. He's a blasphemer. He's this. He's that. And so if we can just get rid of him, all of this will go away. So they project all of this upon Jesus. He dies as a scapegoat on the cross. He forgives them from the cross. And they think that they have done away with him, but God raises him from the dead. Hallelujah. And from that, he vindicates the work of Christ and the teachings of Jesus. And he says, this is my beloved son. Listen to him. Follow him. Love him. And then the rest of the New Testament is the story of how the church has to come to grips with the teachings of Jesus and the love of Jesus. And it takes a while for them to get there because early books in the New Testament, they still don't want anything to do with Gentiles. Okay? But finally, God works by his Spirit through them so that they finally come to a point where I didn't read this earlier, but I will now as we close. 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4. So, what is it then that we are supposed to do? Verse 7 of 1 John 4. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love. Not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. We know that we live in him, and he lives in us, because he has given us his Spirit. And we have seen and testify that the Father has sent his Son to be the Savior of the world. If anyone acknowledges that Jesus is the Son of God, God lives in him, and he in God. And so we know and rely on the love God has for us. God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in him. And in this way, love is made complete among us so that we may have confidence on the day of judgment, because in this world we are like him. There's no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. We love because he first loved us. If anyone says, I love God, yet hates his brother, he's a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And he has given us this command, whoever loves God must also love his brother. So Jesus then becomes the embodiment of what God is really like. And he says, if you love me, you're going to love one another. He who hates his brother. And we're all brothers and sisters because we're human. okay? Yes, there's the family of God, people that have trusted Jesus as Savior, but we're all brothers and sisters because we're all made in the image of God.
Even those that don't profess.
That's right.
Knowing Christ.
That's right. So this is kind of a heavy thing to think about. So root number one, we make God in our own image. Root number two is this idea of desire and how it is projected and how we will use violence to get our way. So we'll stop there. I'll give you a break next week not to have to think about any more of that. We'll come back to another cause, and I'll go over a couple of these slides we didn't have time to get to tonight. So any closing comments or questions before we go?
It was really good.
Good. All right. See you guys Sunday.